This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
Yeah, so the other day, as you know, most of us are, especially now, but constantly, I ordered an Amazon package, and it showed up as it was delivered, and it wasn't there when I went to look for it. And it got me thinking that, you know, a substantial part of all U.S. retail and a growing part of all U.S. retail is based on a delivery model of, you know, you order stuff and it gets dropped off at your house. And basically nobody has a, you know, a locker outside their house, although that does seem to be the future. And very few people have a doorman building. And even people who do have a doorman building, it wasn't built with the capacity to have, you know, a small warehouse in the foyer. So, you know, we essentially trust that people can leave stuff on our porch and it will remain there for, you know, 5 hours until we get home from work. And then it'll be there for us to pick up.
Right.
And I realized that business model of delivery and particularly delivery dropping off, not delivery like a pizza where you're there to receive it, is based, you know, we think of this as based on various things. We think of this as based on first and foremost, just the existence of the internet, and everyone has a cell phone. And, you know, maybe if you think a little harder, you'll think about it in terms of it's based on kind of a sharing economy business model of, you know, people kind of bid for tasks and flexible employment arrangements and all that sort of thing, or competition.
Just the advances in logistics, computer administered sort of delivery systems.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yeah. So you mostly think about things like the kind of like first level thing you'll think about is technology. People have the internet, but actually if you think about it, really mail order could work well with catalogs. Like I'm old enough to remember when you got paper catalogs and you'd get one a month or one a quarter and you called an 800 number and it would say allow 6 to 8 weeks for delivery.
Yeah.
You know, and then, it wasn't fundamentally different to call a number and have someone at the other end of the number typing something into a computer than to go on your own phone, you know, dial up your modem and type it in yourself. Really, it's just the logistics are just amazing nowadays. So you think it's not just the computers, it's also logistics. But I was thinking, actually, probably the most fundamental thing is crime is relatively low.
Yeah.
Like, especially compared to how it was. I mean, I think people often forget this, that we had a huge crime wave in this country from approximately 1965 to approximately 1995. The homicide rate doubled in the 1960s, and it stayed high all the way until the mid-1990s, and then it crashed. And most other crimes went up pretty high, too. And if you go – so if you think when did Amazon launch, I forget exactly when it was, but it was sometime like 1997 or something like that. And – you know, we think of that as the time when everyone had the internet and people had Netscape and that sort of thing. But I think an equally important thing is that people had porches that were not ridden with thieves.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of a necessary condition for that sort of thing. And if you think, imagine if Amazon had launched 7 years earlier in 1990, it would have been in the no radio and car era.
You mean those stickers that people used to put in there? In their windows saying no radio.
Yeah.
You have to explain this because there are younger people who probably don't remember this.
Yeah, so people who are much younger than you or me, I mean, I was born in 1977. I'm 41 years old.
Yeah.
But people who aren't old enough to remember the early 90s or the late 1980s aren't going to remember that people stealing car radios was such a common thing, mostly crackheads. People stealing car radios was such a common thing that people would not leave radios in the car for fear of having them broken into. And when you went to the shopping mall, you would actually pull the radio out of your car and carry it with you into the shopping mall for fear that a thief would break your window to steal the car stereo. And then at a certain point, they realized that they could just have a detachable faceplate, and then you didn't need to carry this like 8-pound radio with you to the Orange Julius, you know. But, you know, it was a common thing to have like no radio in car because we couldn't even leave cars unattended. Now we leave, you know, your $50 Amazon order unattended right there on your porch. Mm-hmm. It's not even in a locked car. You don't have to break glass to get at it. I just think like the end of crime has changed society in this fundamental way. It's changed it. It's allowed a new retail model.
I saw when you posted that on Twitter, and I found that to be very, very insightful, you know, and it's one thing. The other thing is,
of course it was. I said it.
Right. But also, it's like you assume, like people might assume that because now we have like Nest cameras and all that, that those days are long gone. But if everybody started stealing packages, I mean, the police wouldn't be running them all down, I don't think. You know, there's definitely like the general direction of capitalism is one where you're right. It's heavily premised on the idea that there's not a lot of petty crime. Like it's built for our orderly society.
Yeah. I mean, at an abstract level, trust reduces transaction costs.
Right.
Yeah. If we can just trust that you can leave my stuff on my porch and it will still be there 5 hours later when I get home, that obviates the need for, you know, to send it to an Amazon locker, which, you know, makes it just as much hassle as going to the store, albeit a store with effectively infinite inventory. You know, and by the way, I when I order anything worth more than about $100, I will send it to an Amazon locker.
Right.
You know, so I'm not that trusting. You know, I'm not going to order a MacBook and have it left on my porch all day. But something worth $50, $100.
It's funny. Okay. I brought my in-laws up to Canada. It's funny that you say that. They're from Israel, and they were looking. I think there were like a bunch of propane tanks lying outside of a closed supermarket. Like they just didn't bother to bring their stock in when they closed the store. They just left it outside.
Yeah.
And I remember my father-in-law marveling. He's like, "How is this not stolen?" Yeah. He's like, you know. I'm barely restraining myself from taking this stuff. but it's true, you know, there's a lot of ways that our economy operates are premised on the idea that people aren't going to steal.
Yeah.
Like, how about those?
Yeah, go ahead.
Go.
No, you first, please.
All right. Well, no, so like, you know, those stores, like self checkout. Yeah. Is another one like that, like or weighing your own produce at the grocery store. Mm-hmm. You know, all of these are economic models that are premised on the idea that people won't steal. And you're right, in the grand scope of things, it's kind of a novel situation.
Yeah. Now, the really radical thing is realize that retail is just the tip of the iceberg. So, you know, Amazon is a non-trivial part of the U.S. economy, but still a fairly small one as things go. A much bigger part of the U.S. economy is real estate. And, you know, from the mid-1960s onward, we had the hollowing out of central cities and people moving to suburbs.
Right.
And for the last, basically since the end of the crime wave in the mid-1990s, we've seen people moving back into central cities, especially young upscale workers. And, you know, the population density of many central cities has risen. The class has changed. You see this especially in places like Washington, D.C., which has been radically changed since the 1980s. And that was made possible by crime. It was also made possible by a drop in fertility, because people with kids generally prefer to have houses rather than apartments. But it's endogenous, too, because if you prefer to live in an apartment, you'll be more likely to postpone your fertility. So, you know, this is a huge change in terms of like how people live. And it's because it's safe to live in a central city, whereas it was not in the 1980s. In the 1980s, central cities were objectively pretty dangerous. And so that's changed residential decisions. And, you know, that's totally changed the nature of, like, inequality. I mean, I've seen people look at, what's his name? The Capital Book, French economist.
Oh, Piketty.
Yeah, so I've heard people say that, you know, Piketty, it's not really stocks. It's, like, almost all real estate, right? Which essentially, you know, so the aggregate level.
Wait, what's all real estate? Like, oh, what people, what's all?
The aggregate levels of wealth inequality.
Oh, all right. Well, for regular people, yeah.
You know, yeah. So, you know, it's changed patterns of inequality. It's changed assorted mating. It's changed fertility. It's even changed politics, right? I mean, the Democrats are upset that they hit below their weight in congressional elections. But fundamentally, the reason that Democrats hit below their weight in congressional elections is because they have an inefficient distribution across districts, because they have like 90% in cities and then like 45% in distant suburbs. But back when everybody lived in suburbs and not that many people lived in central cities, you didn't have that pattern, and you didn't have that type of issue with so it's changing our politics as well. I mean, it structures everything in our society, directly or indirectly.
It's funny. Yeah, I guess you forget how good times are. I guess that's that Steven Pinker type of argument, right? Like,
yeah,
it's never been so good to be alive as it is now, and or at least that's the argument. And I guess a lot of what we're enjoying are the fruits of that, even if we don't recognize.
Yeah,
that things are so peaceful. All right. Any other takes on this, or?
Yes, actually, I have one more, which is it showed up 2 days later.
What happened? They delivered it to the wrong house?
So that's one possibility. My guess is actually that the package deliverer was running behind on his shift and just scanned it as delivered and then put it in the truck and then dropped it off 2 days later. And so assuming that's right, there's this whole other story we can tell about this, because in that case, this is not a crime story. This is kind of a, a modern Taylorism type thing of the employer tries to monitor the worker through digital means, but also sets a very high, effectively, piece rate economy. The worker finds it unfeasible to maintain that pace of production, and so they cheat, but really, in effect, by cheating, by pretending to meet their production quota, they're really denying themselves overtime by making it seem like that production quota is feasible, which it's not, apparently.
So I've been thinking about this issue of crime and a decrease in crime, and I can't help but thinking about this idea of sort of self-regulation and self-surveillance that seems to be so much part of the organization of our culture now. You know, like, for instance, even like a lot of transit services, for instance, are sort of based on the assumption that you could get arrested if you're cheating, but there's no sort of constant vigilance of every single person that they've paid.
Yeah.
And that's sort of based then on the assumption that you're going to assume that you're always being under some kind of surveillance and you could be caught at any moment. And so then you kind of address your behavior accordingly. Right. And I'm wondering how much of that is part of the process. When we're talking about things like the delivery of Amazon packages. So that was one thing that I was thinking about. Yeah. And the other thing I was thinking about was how, I was just trying to imagine listeners in all sorts of different kinds of settings, you know, different kinds of housing settings, different kinds of communities. And absolutely, there are going to be some communities where people feel a lot more comfortable having their packages left on their porches than others, right? There's going to be certain contexts where people feel really worried and uncomfortable. But I'm thinking about, my own street where, the surveillance system here is neighbors, right? There's people out and about all the time. And I think that, the observant neighbor phenomena is potentially decreasing these days, but certainly in some communities, I think it's still strong. And that would be part of that sort of internalized self-surveillance process, right? Where people are realizing that, like if somebody just walked up to some people's porches and stole stuff, other people are going to see.
Yeah. There's a possibility that it's like upper middle class professors being like, oh, isn't the world wonderful these days? Yeah. Now there's no crime.
Right? I'm like, I don't think so.
There's totally that potential. But also, self-regulation is what an asset to society though, right? Like society sort of builds in that assumption, like, we can do so many things that make life so cheap. Like I think about going on the train and how I can just buy my tickets on on my cell phone, and maybe the guy's going to check it. Maybe he won't on New Jersey Transit. And it keeps the cost of the train down. It allows me to conveniently get my tickets. Like there's just so many assets that this assumption purchases. But is it totally, is this self-regulation thing like an unalloyed good, or do you see like any problematics with it?
Well, I think that certainly some people can maybe feel like they're less likely to be surveilled than others, right? We know that certain people are more likely to be stopped on the train and asked whether they have a ticket or not than others, right? So it's not a system based on sort of equality, I guess, of experience. And it depends, right? Like if you're interested in a sort of certain kind of orderly society, assuming that that society is generally working for the good of everybody, then I suppose, yes, it would make sense. But if you're thinking about issues in society that need to be changed, need to be addressed, inequalities that are being maintained, and that you need people to maybe disrupt and to change things, then if we're all undergoing this sort of massive self-surveillance, then maybe it's not so great.
Yeah.
As you know, Foucault would talk about normalization, right? And how we're sort of reproducing normalization.
It's like breaking our will for independence and sort of freedom in a way. It's like,
right. And then if we've how can we even stand up to injustices if we've so internalized the governmental system that we're embedded in?
It may be like, yeah, it'd be like, well, I know the world's unfair, but you know, if we do something, it might endanger my my Prime 2-day shipping. But you have a stake in it, you know, in a way. It's popular 2-day shipping. Anyhow.
Apparently 2-day shipping is really bad for the environment. That's what I was reading recently.
Oh yeah, totally.
The faster you want something shipped, the greater your footprint in terms of your ordering.
And the human cost. I heard this crazy podcast on the New York Times Daily about what those warehouse workers have to endure. And it sounds awful.
Yeah, really horrible working conditions.
I know, but then you're looking at it, and I was looking on Twitter, and people are like, well, I'm canceling Prime. And like, I want to believe I'm a good person, but geez, I'm really reliant on Prime too. And it makes me feel awful, which maybe I should be feeling awful about.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.